Welcome to the Natural Allergy Treatment Podcast. I'm your host, Jess, and joining me today is Jenny, our PAT expert naturopath based in Auckland, New Zealand. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jess.
We're part of Health and Wellness Australia and Auckland, who are a team of naturopaths around Australia and New Zealand that specialise in a natural allergy treatment called Positive Association Technique, or PAT. So in this episode, we're going to be talking all about gluten, specifically the somewhat controversial topic of gluten sensitivity. So if you've noticed that you experience symptoms when you eat gluten, but you've had all your tests come back clear, this one is for you.
Yeah, so it actually used to only be thought that those with celiac disease react to the protein gluten, which is found in wheat, barley, and rye grains. But recent studies have suggested that a sensitivity to gluten actually affects up to 13% of the population, which is huge. So unfortunately, gluten sensitivity is difficult to diagnose using medical diagnostic methods. So most cases are self-reported.
Yeah, in our clinics, we see many PAT clients reporting gluten sensitivity symptoms. So using our muscle testing technique, we're not only able to confirm their suspicions, but also provide relief from gluten sensitivity symptoms with our completely natural, innovative treatment called PAT.
Yeah, now this is such a big topic. So I've tried to cover as much as what's out there, but there'll probably be bits that I've missed as well. But in this episode, I'll be focusing on the factors that have contributed to the rise of gluten reactions, the different ways that gluten can affect people, be it gluten sensitivity, allergy, or full-blown celiac disease, and most importantly, how we can help.
Yeah, so firstly, let's have a look at what gluten actually is and why it has become such a problem.
Sure. So gluten is a protein that's found in certain grains, specifically the different species of wheat, barley, rye, and triticale. So triticale is a cross between wheat and rye. Oats are often included as containing gluten. And although its protein, which is avian, is similar in structure to gluten, several studies have shown that it actually doesn't affect the body in the same way. But since oats are often grown, processed, and transported alongside the wheat, the barley, and the rye, it means that there can be cross-contamination. So, and that's why it can affect people when they eat oats. So in the plant, gluten is found in the endosperm, which is the part that nourishes the plant embryos during germination. And so it's the main storage protein for these grains. And gluten is a complex mixture of hundreds of related but different proteins. But the main ones are gliadin and glutenin in wheat, sicklin and rye, hordein and barley, and collectively they're referred to as gluten. So gliadin makes up about 70% of the protein in gluten from wheat. And it's gliadin that is responsible for causing an immune response in the body, as it contains peptide sequences that are resistant to being completely broken down in the digestive system. So this causes inflammatory symptoms after eating foods that contain gluten.
And while reactions to gluten are relatively new, gluten in wheat has been around for ages and used in baking for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, so actually the earliest recorded use of the word gluten was in the 16th century, and its origin is the Latin word glutamen, which means glue, because it's a really sticky, elastic texture when you add flour with water. And its protein composition gives bread like that chewy, flexible texture. And when yeasts are added to the dough, gluten's elasticity allows it the bread to rise easily and consistently, which is why it's such an important ingredient in baked goods like bread and cakes and anything that rises, essentially.
Yeah, so apart from those well-known sources like bread, what else is gluten in?
This is actually interesting because it's not where people would normally think of it. So gluten is heat stable, so it can act as a binding or extending agent. So it's commonly used as an additive in processed foods for improved texture, moisture, retention, and flavor, like soups, sauces, meat products, sweets, ice creams, medication, supplements. You know, it's in loads of things. And because gluten is sticky, it's also used in the food industry as an adhesive for processed foods. So, for example, gluten is added to potato chips so that the flavor attaches to the chips and they don't all collect and fall down the bottom of the bag. It's also used for envelopes that you stick down. And there's also a problem for those that are wishing to avoid gluten, because a recent study found that one third of over 5,000 5,500 gluten-free foods actually contained measurable amounts of gluten.
Yeah, it's amazing to think how much gluten is actually in our diet these days. It's really crazy. Yeah. So when it comes down to the different types of reactions that you can have to gluten, we've categorized them into celiac disease, wheat allergy, and gluten sensitivity.
Yeah, so celiac disease and gluten sensitivity has actually been shown to present as many other diseases with different names. So there was a review paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that listed 55 diseases that can be caused by eating gluten, which is crazy.
It is crazy, yeah. So let's start with celiac disease, which is a hereditary autoimmune disorder where consuming gluten actually damages the small intestine.
Yeah, so when a person with celiac disease eats gluten, an immune response is triggered, leading to the immune cells to attack the small intestine. So this alters the mucosa of the small intestine, which flattens and inflames the microvilli, which are on the outsides of the small intestine, which this causes symptoms throughout the whole body, but especially in the digestive system, where there can be diarrhea, malnutrition, and malabsorption of nutrients, and among other symptoms. And not all celiac patients actually have this flattened mucosa. So celiac can occur without this flattened mucosa, and that's called latent celiac disease. And so even eating small amounts of gluten can lead to this small intestine damage. And if it's left untreated, it can lead to like significant health problems, ranging from vitamin and mineral deficiencies to nervous system disorders and lots of gastrointestinal symptoms.
And can this damage to the small intestine actually lead to leaky gut?
Yeah, so leaky gut has long been associated with celiacs, but up until a few years ago, the exact biochemical process influencing the development of leaky gut were not really understood. So in 2013, research was published by Alessio Fanzo from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and he started to shed some light on the mechanisms behind the leaky gut syndrome. So Dr. Fanzo found that a little known molecule called zolein is responsible for opening the gaps between the neighboring epithelial cells of the gut lining. So what that does is the purpose of this molecule is to allow certain nutrients and solutes to get in and out of the intestine. But under certain conditions, too much of the zolein is produced. So it means that there's usually tight junctions between the epithelial cells open up too much. And so it creates this these spaces, which is why it's called leaky gut, because essentially the gut is leaking out. So these overly large gaps between these epithelial cells allow bigger food particles, such as incompletely digested food proteins, to enter the bloodstream. And so then what happens is you get this immune response that's initiated against them, because it's something foreign in the body. It's not you. You get a huge immune response whenever that happens. And so These large intracellular gaps can also allow leakage of intestinal contents like bacteria into the bloodstream as well. So that can cause systemic inflammation and localized damage to the gut epithelia, whilst also overloading the liver's detoxification capabilities. So based on the doctor's research, it's now known that the two most powerful triggers for the release of zolein are the consumption of gliadin and gluten, as well as most forms of dysbiosis, including SBI, candida overgrowth, fungal overgrowth, and parasitic infection. So it's a huge discovery.
Mm. And does this only affect those with celiac disease?
Well, it's been known for a while that gliadin and gluten trigger these autoimmune reactions in people with celiac disease, but it's been a bit more recent in a study from 2006 that showed that gliadin affects zolein levels even in people without the gene for celiac as well. So that's pretty big. And so based on available research, the increase in zolein levels has been linked to a variety of other different autoimmune conditions, including Crohn's disease, type 1 diabetes, and inflammatory bowel disease. So Dr. Fasno, he strongly suggests that if we prevent the interaction of the gut epithelial and the gliadin or the gluten proteins or these the pathogenic microbes and the yeasts, then you can prevent this overproduction of the zolein. So he's saying if you have big problems that you need to avoid the gluten to help repair the gut essentially, and to maintain that proper epithelial barrier function.
Yeah, and I guess anyone who's done a naturopathic protocol when it comes to gut healing, that's one of the main things that's recommended, is to avoid gluten while you're going through that process. And with this autoimmune response to gluten, it can also affect other areas of the body, right?
Yeah, so gluten causes this autoimmune response that causes your body to attack its own tissues. So, but that doesn't just exist in your small intestines. It can also affect your skin. So there's this, it's called dermatitis hiriformis, and it's a chronic, intensely itchy, blistering skin condition that results when gluten causes an autoimmune response on the skin rather than the gut. They look like blisters, like they're, and it's really a terrible thing when somebody has it, because it's so itchy. There's also gluten ataxia, and that's a rare neurological condition in which this autoimmune response to gluten damages the part of your brain called the cerebellum, and that's responsible for coordination and can cause problems with your gait and gross motor skills. So it's a degenerative condition involving the nervous system, and people with ataxia, they have problems with coordination and balance, and may even have slurred speech or problems with fine motor skills. So they start out really mild balance problems usually, but then after that they can become unsteady on their feet or even have trouble moving the legs. And as the symptoms progress, some people say that they feel like they walk or talk like they're drunk, which is, you know, it's rare, but it's a big issue when somebody has it.
Yeah, it'd be very debilitating to have either of those kind of autoimmune disorders as well.
Yeah.
And I guess that explains why removing gluten from the diet is often recommended for anyone who has pretty much any autoimmune issue or inflammatory condition. And the story of how celiac disease was discovered is actually also really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, well, those of you who heard us do the podcast, you'll know that I really like the history of things. And so the concept that somebody could get sick from eating bread has actually been around for centuries. So the Greek physician Aetius of Cappadocia, he wrote the first account of disease around the first century AD, which is obviously like such a long time ago. And he described patients whose food passed through them without being digested. So he called the disease the celiac diathesis, which stems from the Greek word kolia, meaning abdomen. So for centuries afterwards, the diagnosis was actually considered a death sentence because nobody knew the cause or had any treatment for it. And so it wasn't really until the 20th century that it was researched more thoroughly. And then there was a wartime famine, which provided the final clue for how the doctors could help patients with celiac disease. So there was this Dutch pediatrician, William Cartel Dickey, and he had a really long-standing interest in celiac disease. And then in the 1930s, when there was the war going on, he encountered patients this is before the war. So he had patients who told him his symptoms, that their symptoms were worse after eating bread or biscuits. And so he suspected that there was something related to bread was cause of the disease, but he wasn't sure what. And so then the winter hunger came in 1944, and he saw these effects firsthand, because people in the Western Netherlands had to survive on just 500 to 1,000 calories each day, and sometimes even less than that. So it was a really severe famine, and more than 4 million people died or went hungry. And sadly, between 20,000 and 30,000 died. So it was a really tragic time.
Mm.
But during this time, there was no bread that could be found in the cities, with the rare exception of, you know, black marketers, and that stuff was, you know, really barely edible. And so it wasn't that there was a wheat shortage, just that there was basically a complete absence of this wheat. So at the same time, the doctor realized that children with celiac disease were actually seeing improvement in their symptoms, and instead of losing weight, they were actually gaining weight. So that made him really, you know, curious. So then after the famine ended, along with the war in May 1945, food supplies from the Allies started coming in. And so that included wheat and bread, and it basically just flooded the Netherlands. And that's when the doctor made the critical observation. The celiac patients who had been, you know, doing much better had a very clear and rapid relapse. So this connection was enough to get him to thoroughly investigate the relationship between diet and celiac symptoms. And over the next 5 years or so, and through experiments with wheat-free diets, he determined that avoiding foods with wheat and related grains reduced the diarrhea and allowed for weight gain in people with the celiac disease. And they usually felt so much better too. So that was amazing. But, you know, ironically, during this, you know, post-World War II with the Great Depression, pasta and bread were encouraged because they were inexpensive alternatives to the highly rationed foods like meat and dairy in the United States. So it's kind of making it a bit worse. Yeah.
It is such an interesting story and obviously such sad circumstances, but created such a case study to be able to discover something like this. So so celiac disease is where there is the autoimmune response to gluten. So could you explain how a wheat allergy is different from celiac disease or even gluten sensitivity?
Yeah, so a wheat allergy is an allergic reaction to the gluten proteins, specifically gliadin. And the onset of symptoms can take minutes to hours to develop. And that's usually like itching, swelling, sneezing, runny nose, headaches, asthma, stomach aches, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, skin rash, even anaphylaxis. So, you know, so it's huge, can be a lot of symptoms. And the difference is that it's mediated by a different immune response than celiac. So wheat allergies are mediated by the IgE class antibodies and celiac antibodies are the IgA. So people with wheat allergies can safely eat spelt as well as barley and rye, while those with celiac can't. In most cases are found in children and it's usually diagnosed through a skin prick test or a blood test. And some people can grow out of it, unlike celiac, which is, you know, for life.
So now we'll move on to what's formally known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is where you may not test positive for celiac disease on, say, a blood test or the biopsy or a gluten allergy on a blood test, but you still experience these symptoms when you consume gluten.
Yeah, so gluten and wheat sensitivity has been clinically recognized it's less severe than celiac disease because people with gluten sensitivity do not test positive for celiac disease based on blood testing. And they were thought not to have damage to their small intestines found, but that's kind of changed. And we'll talk a little bit about that further down the track. And so although like celiac disease symptoms are linked to gluten consumption and it promotes this chronic inflammatory state, their symptoms will resolve when they avoid these gluten containing foods. And so if you are a non-celiac gluten sensitivity, then you're likely to experience sort of extra intestinal, like non-gastrointestinal symptoms like eczema, headaches, brain fog, ADHD, behavioral issues, joint pain, numbness in the legs and arms or fingers. But then you actually still can get these classic gastrointestinal symptoms like bloating, gas, nausea, diarrhea, constipation. Like it's huge.
It's a wide range of symptoms, yeah. So if you are struggling with what you suspect to be non-celiac gluten sensitivity, you can get a copy of our free PAT information e-pack to learn more about how PAT may be able to help you not only confirm your suspicions, but actually get relief from these gluten sensitivity symptoms. So I'll pop a link to that in our show notes as well. But the interesting thing is that those with gluten sensitivity can actually have evidence of damage to that intestinal wall you mentioned without the autoimmune markers.
Yeah. So until now, it was you know, people thought that they only experienced symptoms, but they didn't get any intestinal damage. But there's in July 2016, a team of researchers at the Columbia University Medical Center, they published a study confirming that wheat exposure in this group is in fact triggers a systemic immune reaction and the accompanying intestinal cell damage. And so it's estimated that the impacted population is equal to or even exceeds the number of individuals with celiac disease. And for some reason, most of them are, you know, basically undiagnosed.
Yeah. And I also came across a few articles saying that FODMAPs are part of the issue. And I know that we do usually need to address sugars and FODMAPs as part of our treatments when people are reacting to wheat products. So are they part of the issue?
Yeah. So at this point, the research has not confirmed that celiac is the culprit for this triggering the immune reaction, as in the case with celiac disease. There's other potential culprits as well. So they've got the amylase trypsin inhibitors, the fructans, which are found in the FODMAPs, and each of these also have gluten in them. So gluten may not be the cause of the syndrome. So they're just still trying to work it out. But there's a lot of research going on in this area. So it's gaining way more interest in the scientific fields.
Yeah, and you also came across some interesting research about brain fog, didn't you?
Yeah, so a lot of people with celiac disease and gluten sensitivity, they can tell when they've been accidentally gluten. That's kind of like a terminology that they say, because their brains cloud up and they feel less effective, even a bit silly and clumsy. So this phenomenon known as brain fog has undergone not a lot of study, but it is another really common symptom. But here in New Zealand University of Otago, researchers have found that wheat gluten causes brain inflammation in mice. So while previous studies have shown that gluten promotes body mass and inflammation in mice in their enteric nervous system and their gastrointestinal tract, they investigated actually this impact on the brain. And so the brain has two types of immune cells similar to macrophages in the blood, and these are called astrocytes and the microglia. And they found that gluten, as well as a high-fat diet, increases the number of those immune cells, and the effect of gluten added to a normal diet increased the cell number of this to the extent if mice were fed a high-fat diet and gluten was added to the diet, these cell numbers went up even further. So the hypothalamic region of the brain is vital for coordinating basic metabolic functions like body weight regulation and blood sugar regulation. So what they've kind of concluded is if gluten led to hypothalamic inflammation in humans, that would cause brain damage. And it can also be bad in the long run because it can increase their body weight and impair their blood sugar regulation. So if this became persistent, then they might be at higher risk of impaired memory function. And it's also linked to, distributed blood sugar regulation, which is, the hypoglycemia and all of that, that happens as well.
Yeah. And are there any other potential effects on the brain as well?
Yeah. So other research shows that people with celiac disease often suffer much higher than average rates of depression and anxiety. So people who test negative for celiac disease but who have been diagnosed with gluten sensitivity also report high levels of depression and anxiety. And although the links have kind of become, they don't know yet, they're speculating that, one, that could be this brain inflammation, but also if there's gluten-related intestinal damage, it might lead to nutritional deficiencies that cause depression because and anxiety, because people with celiac disease, when you have a mineral deficiency and B vitamins, it can actually make those symptoms worse.
And I also imagine another potential part would be the frustration of knowing that you're reacting to something but not actually being able to get that confirmation. So we also hear a lot of medical gaslighting goes on when it does come onto gluten sensitivity.
Definitely.
So yeah, and going gluten-free is sometimes viewed, I guess, by people who don't know about all this research as just a fad diet or that you're being fussy. So that would be really frustrating when it comes to those social situations as well.
Yeah.
And I guess this confusion stems from I guess gluten's been in our diet for generations, so why are we actually reacting to it more nowadays?
Yeah, so loaves have actually been found in ancient Egyptian tombs dating back to 1500 BC, but it wasn't until about 300 BC that humans discovered adding yeast made the bread rise. But over the decades, further down the track, we've created new strains of wheat, and that's making and it made the grains larger, and at the same time it increased the amount and changed the composition of the gluten that they contain. So they did a recent study, and they compared frozen serum samples collected in 1948 and 1952 to serum samples collected in 2002. And after verifying the stability of the IgA antibodies in the old samples, the investigator concluded that gluten allergies and celiac disease were at least four times more prevalent today than they were 60 years ago. Another thing that's interesting is initially bread wasn't actually eaten a lot due to the amount of labor it required to turn into bread. These early forms of wheat weren't frequently consumed by humans because you had to mill it and then you had to cook it. And some cultures did eat wheat berries and grind their wheat for certain uses, but because it was different grain size as well, that gluten consumption wasn't nearly as high as it is today. And one thing that's really interesting is when wheat was introduced into Europe during the Middle Ages, so not really that long ago, it's actually discovered that about 30% of the European people of European descent carry the gene for celiac disease, which is HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8. And that increases a susceptibility to health problems from eating gluten. So, that could be that they have more likely to get a sensitivity to it than other people.
Yeah. And has the type of wheat used in agriculture actually changed?
Yeah. So I was saying how, you know, the grains got bigger. So what happened is due to crossbreeding over like many years, modern wheat's composition kind of went through this change. So the worldwide rise in celiac disease occurred at the same time as the introduction of dwarfed wheat. And that contains much higher amounts of the genes for gluten. So Dr. Hetty Van Brodick, she studied wheat and the gluten proteins that are responsible for celiac disease. And she was part of this research group in Holland that compared gluten proteins in modern wheats to like the old style wheats that were grown like a century ago. And so the presence of celiac disease, this is a specific culprit in it. It's called Glia-A9 epitope. And it's much higher in modern wheat. So she believes that modern wheat breeding has increased the protein parts that causes celiac disease. She also states that these new grains, they grow faster, but they have got less nutrients because of it. And the new strains are bred to be dependent. Well, this is in like the, you know, Western world. They're bred to be dependent on agrochemical sprays for them to survive. And so, you know, the original shorter plants, they can't compete with all the weeds. And the newer strains, they have these little stubby roots, which means that they actually have a lower nutrient uptake, and they're not growing for as long. So they're not absorbing, you know, nutrients from the soil.
Yeah. So wheat is actually less nutritious than it used to be too.
Yeah, so they had this, there's another study called the Broad Fork Wheat Experiment, and that's been spanning for more than a century. So this is not just like, you know, one thing that they've done. And so they documented the decline in the nutrition of modern wheat. So since 1843, these generations of investigators have grown wheat in like parallel plots. And each year the harvest is tested for its nutritional content. And so even though this yield increased a lot when the dwarf wheats were introduced, the nutritional value plummeted 18 to 25%, and the mineral content of zinc, iron, copper, magnesium, phosphorus, manganese, sulfur, calcium, like a huge range. And there was also new research into the gluten structure in modern wheat that it also contains high levels of the starch amylopectin A. And so amylopectin digestion might raise blood sugar and insulin levels, causing this increase in triglycerides and cholesterol, which can lead to fat accumulation, especially around the trunk area. So that goes back up to also, you know, the brain inflammation from the wheat as well.
Yeah. So this change to wheat's composition has contributed to the rise of gluten issues, but is it actually the amount that we're eating these days which is part of the problem?
Yeah. So, you know, as I was saying before, before the Industrial Revolution and things like that, but people didn't eat wheat a lot. It was hard to mill and it took a long time. But so it wasn't really until the 19th century that wheat got to be milled in these large quantities. And so therefore gluten got a much more prominent role or place in the diet. And also as global transport improved and like things like railroads were built across America, it became much more easy and inexpensive to mill and distribute the wheat. So that therefore there was so much more of it around. And then this is the old controversial. In 1992, the American Food Guide Pyramid was created by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1992. I'm sure that you've seen the big triangle with, you know, all the grains down the bottom and you know, telling you how much you should eat. So it was released and it listed that whole grains was one of the most important fruit groups, like, you know, down the bottom. It was saying that you should eat at least 6 to 11 servings of whole grains per day. And so this kind of like further solidified the prevalence of wheat and other grains in this American diet. And around that time, the celiac cases started to begin to rise. But the irony of this is that at the same time that they made that that pyramid, there was a surplus of grains in America because they, you know, introduced this new dwarf wheat and it was growing really, really fast. So they had extra grains that they actually needed to use up. So originally, the food pyramid was only suggested to be 3 to 4 servings, but because they had all this excess grain, they bumped it up to 6 to 11 servings so that they could use the extra grains up. So now today's wheat's like most widely grown crop in the world, which I just find crazy.
Yeah,
And then a scientist at the USDA He estimates that Americans' gluten intake per capita has tripled since 1977. And those people that eat commercially baked whole grain wheats, they're actually getting way more of gluten as well.
Yeah, so our consumption has just skyrocketed over years. So it makes sense that's part of the reason why we're seeing this increase in these reactions. But the other problem is how we make bread and other baked goods these days as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so in commercial bakeries, rising time of bread with yeast, and it has windowed from hours or even days to mere minutes. So now they put in these like fast-acting yeasts and additives. Up until about 100 years ago, bread was left to rise for at least 12 hours. And this long fermentation process allows natural, airborne bacteria to actually start breaking down those carbohydrates and the gluten in the bread. So it makes it much easier to digest and releases the nutrients within it. So it allows our body to more easily absorb them. So that's why some gluten-sensitive people can still eat like sourdough bread that's made the traditional way, but they can't go near any of the commercial. And the other thing that is, and actually, if any of you are listening to this and are at home, go to the back of your bread and have a look at the back, because commercial bakers, they actually add a lot of extra gluten into their products. So if you read the label on the back of supermarket sliced bread, and actually, crazily, especially if it's a whole wheat one, you'll likely find the words wheat gluten among probably the top four ingredients, because they actually put extra gluten in, because they, especially if it is whole wheat flour, because whole wheat flour has a lower gluten density than white flour. So the industrial bakeries, they add the extra gluten to make the bread more elastic, like white bread.
And it's just the irony that a lot of people eat brown bread trying to get the whole grains and make a healthier choice, but you end up getting more gluten.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's wild, yeah. So as you can see, gluten is such a big topic and there's so much more research out there that's still being done. But I guess we just want to emphasize a couple of the take-home messages is to be aware or mindful of just how much gluten is actually present in our modern diets, and that this gluten sensitivity is a real thing. So if you feel that you are reacting to gluten, despite all your test results coming back clear, we may be able to help with positive association technique.
Yeah, so gluten sensitivity can really be implicated in various symptoms associated with eczema, IBS, brain fog, headaches. You know, as I was saying before, there's quite a lot of symptoms all throughout the body that can actually be caused by it. And so we're all qualified naturopaths and at the clinics, and we use a form of muscle testing or kinesiology to assess your reactions to various food chemicals like gluten, as well as a wide range of food and airborne and chemical substances. And so how the muscle testing works is that you hold onto a sample vial of the substance, and we're looking for a change in your muscle strength to indicate a reaction. So if the muscle in your arm stays strong, that shows that your body is okay with that. But if the muscle weakens, then it indicates a reaction to the substance. And so then we use a chiropractic tool called an Apustim to stimulate the nerve bundles and the acupressure points at either side of your spine. And then while you're holding onto that substance, we help to retrain your body to no longer have a negative reaction to the substance.
Yeah, so if you're interested in learning more about positive association technique, I'll also pop a link in our show notes for the previous episode we did called What is PAT, where we go into much more depth about how it all works. You can also visit our website, naturalallergytreatment.com.au, to get some more information. Otherwise, make sure you subscribe to our channel. We've got some really interesting episodes coming up next too.
Yeah, so next we're going to be talking about how to take care of your skin barrier during winter. And then I'm really excited to do one all about the gut microbiome, because that's massive and really interesting.
That'll be another big one too, Jenny. All right, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Great.
Speak to you soon.
Thanks. Speak to you soon.